This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Blacks and women have won the right to serve in the military. Homosexuals have not. They're barred from military service. Gays who are discovered in the military face investigation, interrogation, and discharge. My guest, Alan Berube, is a gay historian and author of the new book Coming Out Under Fire, A History of Gays and Lesbians in World War II. According to Berube, over 18 million men and women were screened by draft boards during the war. Only 4,000 to 5,000 were rejected for homosexuality. Berube says the homosexuals who made it through the screening process found themselves fighting two wars, one for American democracy and freedom, the other for their own survival as homosexuals within the military organization. I asked Berube to describe the current regulation that bans homosexuals from the military.
Right now, it declares that homosexuality is incompatible with military service and that anyone who has a propensity towards homosexuality is a threat to the military.
What does propensity for homosexuality mean?
It means either that you say that you're a homosexual or that you might want to be in a homosexual relationship, anything indicating that you might be gay or lesbian.
What is the military's reason for thinking that homosexuality is incompatible with serving in the military?
That's a very good question. I wish they would start talking about it. They're not talking about it. They just make these assertions and statements and don't give the evidence or reasons behind the policy. All we can do is guess, I think. I mean, what they say is that gay men and women are a threat to security, morale and discipline, recruitment, public relations, privacy. It's basically if you believe all of it, it means that the presence of a homosexual would completely destroy the entire military organization. That can't be the truth. I mean, it's just not true. So you can guess that it might be that they don't want it to be known that there are homosexuals in the military. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm. When the military says that gays and lesbians endanger national security, that's because they think that gays and lesbians could be more easily blackmailed by people who are threatening to drag them out of the closet?
That's right. And on surface, that sounds like it makes sense. In fact, there have been no cases of any gay man or lesbian who have been blackmailed in the military for being gay. So it's a hypothetical question that there's no evidence to back it up.
And the fear that gays and lesbians would hurt recruitment, that has to do with that straight people would be fearful of serving knowing that there were gays and lesbians in their midst?
Yeah. I mean, it's really kind of ridiculous because there's gay men and lesbians everywhere. The fear, I think, is if the military were to say that there were gay men and lesbians in the military, then other people would be afraid to join up.
The Supreme Court recently declined to hear two appeals, one by a gay and one by a lesbian, who were discharged for homosexuality. Do you consider this a great setback?
Not necessarily. That's what we expected, pretty much. And it doesn't indicate anything, really. It's just because they didn't say why they didn't hear them. The traditional policy of the courts, the stance of the courts, is to defer to the military in most of these cases. That really it's up to the military to decide what they want to do.
One of the current issues surrounding gays in the military has to do with ROTC on college campuses. And major universities have been warning the Pentagon that anti-gay policies are generating pressure to ban ROTC from campus. And this week, John Deutsch, the provost of MIT, wrote a letter to Defense Secretary Dick Cheney saying, quote, "The contradiction between the university's principle of non-discrimination against individuals on the basis of sexual orientation and the presence of an ROTC that does discriminate cannot exist on the campuses indefinitely." What's the background to this? Is this a story you've been following?
Yes. During most of this year, there have been a number of cases on many college campuses, and increasing numbers of cases, it seems, or there's more publicity given to them, of gay ROTC students being kicked off out of the programs because they are gay. The worst one of the worst cases was in St. Louis, where a man came out in his senior year and was ordered to pay back his entire scholarship of $25,000 or more. The policy is patently mean-spirited. I mean, it just seems to be unfair for people to have to pay back their scholarships when they come out. It seems that way on campuses. And so what's interesting is that there's faculty on campuses and young students on campuses who are both bringing up this issue of discrimination.
Alan Berube is my guest, and he's written a new book on the history of gay men and women in the military in World War II, and the book is called Coming Out Under Fire. Alan, do you know how the spread of AIDS is affecting the way the military treats homosexuals and the way the military perceives homosexuality?
Yes, the military was one of the first federal organizations to begin mandatory testing. It was the first one, I think, of its personnel. And as a result, thousands and thousands of young people, primarily those who are coming into the military, have been tested. Where the danger is in terms of homosexuality is where the military equates being antibody positive with being gay, which is certainly not the case at all. And the other difficulty for the military is that they are finding people who are antibody positive who are doing their jobs well. And the policy of wanting to discharge everybody who is antibody positive becomes difficult for the organization. So they've been trying to figure out ways of keeping people in even though they're antibody positive. And in a way, it really brings up the contradictions with the anti-gay policy, too, because, in fact, the military does not want and cannot discharge everyone who is gay or lesbian. Otherwise, it would be so disruptive of the military organization it couldn't function. So what it tries to do is try to figure out ways to keep people quiet about being gay.
Your new book, Coming Out Under Fire, is an examination of gays and lesbians during World War II in the military.
That's right.
Why are you looking to World War II?
World War II, I discovered, was the beginning of the military's anti-gay discharge policy. It had no such policy in World War I, and it was in the middle of World War II, in January of 1943 to be exact, when both the Army and the Navy adopted policies to discharge homosexuals from the armed forces.
And what was the reason for that?
It's a funny story. It's kind of an irony because it was spearheaded in part by psychiatrists who were objecting to the military's previous practice of putting men convicted of sodomy into prison for 10 to 12 years. They felt that was cruel and unjust, and that their new idea was that homosexuals were mentally ill, not criminals, and therefore should be discharged. I mean, that's an argument that's been discredited in the 1970s. But at that point, it was a progressive argument, and it was positioned against the military's treating homosexuals as criminals. So it was just that moment in time when psychiatrists were beginning to have an influence in the armed forces. It backfired on them right away, and the other military officials started using the policy to punish gay men and then lesbians as women got into the armed forces for being gay.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what the screening process was during World War II for screening out gays and lesbians?
Yeah, that was introduced again for the first time during World War II. And at the induction centers and draft boards, the examiners would say to the men, do you like girls? Actually, they were supposed to say, are you a homosexual or do you have homosexual tendencies? But many of them, I think, were shy about that. And many young men had no idea what that word meant, homosexual. So they would say, do you like girls? They didn't screen women for homosexuality until in the Women's Army Corps until late in the war, until late 44, after which, when most of the women had already been recruited. Part of that was because of the pressure to conserve all female personnel as much as possible because the Women's Army Corps had much difficulty meeting their quotas during the war.
How did the screening process that was created during World War II compare with today's screening process?
It's very similar. They still ask people if, now they ask enlisted personnel if they have homosexual tendencies. Apparently they ask officers, do you have any problems with homosexuality? During the Vietnam War, it was interesting because so many people were, it was such an unpopular war, and homosexuality had lost some of its stigma that many, many people said they were gay or some heterosexual draftees claimed to be gay in order to avoid military service. There's no evidence that happened during World War II.
Mm-hmm. So previously, if you were caught in the act of sodomy, you were sent to prison. In
yes.
World War II, when that was changed and homosexuality was considered a psychiatric problem, were the consequences, how did the consequences change?
People still got sent to prison. There was always that backup policy. That policy still exists. And two lesbians were just sentenced to prison and served their sentences for sodomy last year at Parris Island in the Marine Corps. So that system still exists. How it changed is it allowed the military to discharge someone, this is in World War II, with an undesirable discharge. You lost your benefits and you lost your GI rights, and you had an undesirable discharge, which could affect your employment too, especially during the war. And it allowed the military to punish a much larger group of people, because the number of people who could be sent to prison, the prisons had only so much space, but there was no place to hold people in for years and years if they were discharged. So the numbers increased a lot over the numbers of people who could have been sent to prison. It also allowed the military to deal with women, because women were generally not sent to prison for offenses like this, and they could be punished nevertheless. Also, people didn't have any rights before a discharge board. None of the rights of due process that you would have at a trial if you had been charged with sodomy.
Is the discharge still a dishonorable discharge?
Currently, for the most part, it's honorable. It's an honorable discharge and mandatory. In other words, if the regulation is anyone who is known to be homosexual has to be discharged. The irony right now is that if a man gets caught having sex with another man, but he says that he is not gay, then he can be maintained in the, retained in the military. Hmm. It's the being gay, not the sex act so much, that is disturbing to the military.
What were the interrogations like when the military is trying to get a confession from a gay or lesbian?
They were excruciating and really incredibly invasive, cruel situations. They would usually be more than one person interrogating a person. Say, at Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, there was an intensive investigation that involved interrogations in early 1944. They would take a woman in one by one and sit her down and ask her if she was a homosexual, and that we have evidence that you've engaged in homosexual practices. She would be completely shocked and taken aback, told that she could not talk to anybody else about what was going on, and then systematically asked incredibly personal questions about her sexual activities, her sexual pleasures, what positions she took, and it just got incredible detail. And each time that a woman would start crying, for instance, and they would just move in to try to get names of people that she knew, the goal was to get her to confess to being a homosexual or a man who was being interrogated and get them to name names of other people.
Are there still, is there still interrogation of gays and lesbians in the military?
Yes, there still is.
And the idea is the idea still to get that person to confess and to name other people?
Yes, yes, exactly. And in the policy says when someone needs, it has to be discharged if they state that they have a propensity towards homosexuality, that statement can take place under interrogation. In other words, if you're interrogated for hours and hours and grilled, and you finally admit that you're gay, that's what's called, that's what the statement is, that you are gay, and that's sufficient to get you discharged. So that's what they're looking for, is that admission. People often think that it's someone saying out loud in public, I am gay, and then they're the problem ones. But that statement can take place after hours and even days of interrogations.
Do you think there was a gay subculture in the military during the war?
It was there, yes, and it was actually quite extensive, although secret and quiet. But as far as I can tell, there were the gay cliques and gay circles of friends and lesbian circles of friends on virtually every base in the United States of any size. They would hang out at the service clubs sometimes, or hang out, meet each other in town at the a local gay bar. They had all kinds of clever ways that they would just discover from meeting each other. One woman told me that she took out a book on the Air Force Base library that was called Diana. It was a lesbian novel from 1939. You know, there was like 20 books on the library, and one of these was a lesbian novel. She put her name in the back, and then she returned it. And then a gay man had taken it out after her, noticed her name, and that's how they met each other.
Hmm. Now, you said that after World War II, restrictions against gays and lesbians actually tightened.
Yes.
Why?
I think because the constraints of wartime, which pressured military officials to conserve all personnel, the men and the women, those constraints were lifted so that the anti-gay policy that really emerged during the war could develop even more fully. In other words, they could, especially against lesbians, because lesbians after the war in the military, women in the military after the war, became a much more deviant type of group. All the other women were leaving the military. They were moving, you know, into the families and homes, into more traditional female role, jobs for women, those women who chose to stay in the military were seen to be more deviant than they had been during the war, where they were seen as being patriotic and really serving their country.
In the early 1950s, the military restrictions against gays were extended to the rest of the government.
That's right.
How did that happen?
There was a hearing during the McCarthy era, and the anti-communist hearings in the Senate during 1950 expanded in the middle of that year to include homosexuals. There were a few anti-gay and anti-communist senators who wanted to start holding hearings, which they did, about what they called the employment of homosexuals and other sex perverts in government. The Senate investigative committees held hearings all through the late part of 1950, and what they wanted to do was to take this model the military had developed, which was to have an anti-gay policy towards its personnel and extend that to the entire government. Their argument was that all homosexuals were security risks, and that was what they were trying to promote. They succeeded. And within a couple of years, President Eisenhower issued an executive order making it mandatory to not hire and to fire anyone in the federal government who was known to be gay. It also applied to all private contractors with the federal government.
Do you have any estimate of how many homosexuals were fired from federal positions, from government positions then?
It was several thousand in the first part of the 1950s. In 1950 itself, it's interesting, during the first part of the year, it was an average of about six per month who were fired from the federal government for being gay. By the end of that year, it shot up to 60 per month. And it was directly related to this beginning of a really nationwide witch hunt against gay men and lesbians in federal jobs.
When was this hiring policy reversed?
Well, it still exists in a lot of cases, but I think civil service in the late 70s was had a new regulation saying that a lot of government employees would not be fired just because of their sexual orientation. The policy certainly still exists in the military and in many other federal agencies.
Okay, looking back at World War II, and the role and the condition of gays and lesbians in the war, mm-hmm. What effect do you think their participation in the military and the military's reaction to them had on the future gay rights movement? Any?
Yeah, I think it was in that relationship, in that conflict, were sown some of the seeds of the later gay rights movement. This is another irony of this story. Those who were discharged, there were at least 9,000 or to 10,000 during the war. Because of the new GI rights bill, they were already avenues for appealing those discharges available to them at the end of the war. So many of them began talking about their situation as one that was unjust. The psychiatrists were talking about the treatment of homosexuals as a form of grave injustice. The GI Bill gave a language of rights. People had rights as veterans. So they would talk about their rights being violated. They were treated as if they were a group of people that was all the same, that if you were a homosexual, then you belonged to this group and you were going to be treated as a group. And right after the war was when the talk of homosexuals being a persecuted minority, the use of the word minority, really begins being used in some magazines and other publications right after the war. So that language of rights, justice, minority, persecution, and appeals, redress of grievances, really grows out in part from the military experience. And it was the first gay male veterans the first gay organization in the United States that was a large membership organization was a group of gay veterans in New York City called the Veterans Benevolent Association, which was formed right after World War II.
Have you ever been in the military yourself?
No, I haven't.
Tell me why researching the military has become so important to you.
It's really funny. During the war in Vietnam, I was a conscientious objector, and now I'm seen as kind of an expert on military policy. It's a very strange turn of events. I'm realizing that the military plays a very important role in social in shaping society and in bringing about social change, either for the net positive or the negative. They really had a major role to play in integrating the armed forces. You know, when the armed forces were integrated racially in the early 1950s, that was ahead of many other organizations in the United States. The military was the first to bring about mandatory AIDS testing. it's a real pioneer in many ways, for the better or for the worse. It's also a place where many people who are poor and working class have their lives and even sexuality shaped by the military. And that's very interesting to me, to look at that part of the way social change comes about. And I think it's a real neglected part of social history, too.
Perhaps because so many gays and lesbians have formed alternative cultures in a way, since mm-hmm. they've been shut out of the mainstream in so many circumstances, it's hard to see the gay rights movement as being very compatible with the military, which is about regimentation, mm-hmm. and which do you think that there's anything like a gay rights movement within the military now, and are the two incompatible?
There are certainly different styles. There's the kind of counterculture style of gay liberation that came out of the late 60s and early 70s, and that, I would say, is pretty incompatible with military service. What's happened in the 80s, and certainly is going to happen in the 90s, is that the discussion of rights and gay men and lesbians is really broadening a lot. I think one thing that we're beginning to see now is that really extending to the armed forces, where people in the armed forces who are gay and lesbian are beginning to speak up, are saying, I cannot help anymore to maintain the lie that I'm not here. I'm here, and I have a right to be here like I have a right to be everywhere else. So there's a kind of a beginning of almost a gay rights or gay liberation movement that's coming from within the military, and it's going to have a very different style than the gay rights movement that grew out of the early 70s.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Berube is the author of the new book, Coming Out Under Fire, The History of Gay Men and Women in World War II. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.